Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 126, being recorded on the 4th of May, 2016, with special guest Brian Belmont. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Evan and our special guest, Brian. Evan, I believe Kale's at the conference, right? He's still at the blockchain conference, I think.
Yeah, he is. You know, and he's going to be bummed because there's another post about blockchain, and he can make all of our listeners' heads hurt talking about blockchain and all the ins and outs of that. So, yeah. But, yeah, I don't think he's going to make it today.
Okay. So, and before we give the mic over to Brian, and we really appreciate him taking the time. Brian's a very special person in the Azure team, and of course we all want to hear what he has to say about Azure support. But before we get there, let's just quickly go through some of the updates that happened this past week. There were a few of them, but let's talk about a couple that I think are near and dear to us. The one that caught my eye was the IoT Gateway SDK. Did you see that one, Evan?
Yeah, I saw that come across. I hadn't had a chance to look at that.
So that's a pretty cool thing. You know, we have a company, typical company has a whole bunch of IoT devices, and they're, you know, the normal ways for all of them to talk to Azure, right, to the Azure IoT Hub. But it sometimes makes sense for them to talk to some sort of a gateway on-premise itself, and that itself will talk to Azure, right? So like a gateway device.
So rather than everybody having their own channel, they're kind of going through a funnel channel at that point.
Correct. And the advantage to that, there's a couple of advantages that they've cited over there which made a lot of sense to me. One is, okay, not all IoT devices can talk HTTP. Like some of the older ones have some, you know, weird protocol that they talk. So this way they can talk to the gateway internally, and the gateway then can translate that to HTTP or the standard protocol that the IoT Hub requires. And the other thing is that, you know, it can also do some sort of analysis on the data going out to take some action quicker instead of waiting for it to go all the way to the IoT Hub and the IoT Hub running some job and figuring out, hey, you know, there is whatever, there's some maintenance required on this thing. It could catch a lot of things beforehand by looking at that right within that gateway device. So essentially, it's just an SDK that they provided, and you have to actually build the gateway software or the executable and run it on a machine, I guess on your DMC, I suppose. But most of the smarts are in this SDK, so it makes it real easy for them. And they've written in such a way that you can run it, you can use a Linux application or a Windows application. They've used standard NCC to write it, which is pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah, no, that's neat.
So that's one. Any of them that catch your eye, or
the one that caught my eye, right? We're you know, we talked about this before about when you're doing most deployments in Azure, right? Your dominant cost tends to be compute, right? Mm-hmm. But we did announce that for the academic community, you know, people that meet the criteria in certain, you know, certain zones and are in the academic world, we're going to waive egress fee as well. Yeah. Right, again, and again, that's not generally a dominant factor of someone's bill, but, you know, anything to make it easier for those folks to play with a service, demonstrate what can be done, and ideally come up with some really neat things. I mean, I think that's we give a lot of credits to, you know, those type of communities for, you know, people to play on this stuff. We get the MSDN subscriptions, but this is just, you know, yet another way to kind of give people an inexpensive way to try the platform out.
Yep, that's I was very excited about that too. And one more we can touch on real quick before we get Brian on is about, and might actually relate to some of our discussions with Brian later on, is this, the data lake now supports, has a Java SDK. I think you recall we spoke to Arindam Chatterjee, who is the PM in the data lake team.
Yep.
A few episodes ago, and he gave us some good insight into the product, essentially being able to upload data, do analytics on it, and now you can do that with Java, you know, if you've got a Java app.
I mean, I think that's, I mean, we've talked about this before, and this will probably actually be one of the questions that I do want to ask Brian, but, you know, I mean, this is such a different world from where we were, you know, a couple of years ago, where if it wasn't .NET, you know, we didn't care.
Exactly.
You know, and I actually, there was a conversation on one of the teams that I used to be on, the Azure networking team today. You know, somebody was saying, hey, do we have a Java SDK for some of the REST APIs? And today we don't for the services they were looking at. But, you know, it's very clear we're moving in that direction, right? We can't get everything all at once, you know, so that it takes time. But man, this is, I mean, we never would have released SDKs for PHP and Java in the same week for different services, right? I mean, that's not, just not likely. So, but yeah, so,
Well, but without further ado, Evan, can you introduce our guest, please?
yeah, sure. Brian, and we'll let you jump in and kind of, you know, maybe introduce yourself as well. But Brian is the general manager for Azure Support. Brian and I have worked real closely together for a number of years now. I thought it would be fun to invite him on and kind of get his perspective as a business manager of what it's like to be Azure. So, Brian, you want to give a quick intro?
Yeah, so I think you did a pretty good job. But so I am the really technically the general manager for CNE Serviceability. So my day job there is really our relationship between CSS and cloud and enterprise engineering team. So Scott Guthrie's team across all of our products. And kind of as a sideline, I've been running the global Azure delivery team virtually, as well as some of the delivery team in my direct org for the last year or so. So, you know, because I'm involved in Azure, that means I spend about 110% of my time in Azure and relatively little time on all the other parts.
I was
So.
going to say, you know, for your side job, you know, this is pretty much all you do. I mean, or at least all there's time in the day to do, right? I mean,
Yeah,
it feels
exactly.
that way. So, but yeah, no, go ahead, Sujeet.
I just wanted to clarify a couple of acronyms over there for our listeners that may not be aware of them. So you mentioned, I think CSS is something that you mentioned, Brian.
Yep.
So could you break it down for maybe our listeners to what some of those teams are and what they do?
Yeah, so CSS, I think, stands for Customer Service and Support. So it's basically our support organization at Microsoft and supports everything from Xbox to Azure and SQL Server and pretty much all of our enterprise products. So we're part of that organization.
Okay, and so continue then. You were saying, so how does that relate to your role and what you do within the Azure team?
Yeah, so you know, one of the key benefits of support in some ways is our ability to be the voice of the customer. And so within CSS, there's an organization called Serviceability, and that's broken up and really aligned by our relationship with the engineering group. So I own Serviceability for our cloud and enterprise engagement, which means basically my team works with Scott Guthrie's team across, you know, certainly Azure, but also Windows Server, SQL Server, developer technologies, really all of the technologies that live within the CNE engineering team. And our role there is really make sure that as we're seeing support cases and we're understanding what's going on with products that are both in market and increasingly getting involved sort of earlier in the development stage. So we're actually influencing sort of the features and functionality that would help us support a product better before it's released. You know, we're engaging with engineering on that. So, you know, if you think specifically about Azure, you know, what are the types of cases we're seeing? You know, what can we go back and drive in the platform that will either eliminate the issue that resulted in the customer opening that case in the first place, or at minimum, how can we help our support engineers solve that case faster and better next time so we can do a better job for the customer? And Evan, I mean, you can probably speak even more deeply about kind of that connection between, you know, support engineering and.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Brian.
No, I just say between, you know, kind of being an engineer taking cases and how we sort of then, you know, bring that back to the engineering team and work through that.
Yeah, no, and I think Brian kind of put it well, Sujeet, and really to some extent you can think about it, and I say it half in jest, is when Brian's efforts fail is when delivery steps in, which is my kind of my half of the org, right? We do everything we can to make the platform sustainable, and Brian's team kind of, you know, helps lead and drive those conversations, and we funnel data through them. We work really, really closely with them. But at the end of the day, if a case comes in, my team is the one that actually does that kind of customer direct work. Right, and then we partner based on what we see in that space, the things we run into, the challenges we need, maybe the changes we need from a tooling perspective, or additional features in the product, or changes in the features. We then collaborate with Brian's team so they can aggregate that stuff and go make the, you
I
know,
see, I see.
the business case and that kind of stuff. Because again, my team's focus is hey, we're on the phone with the customer, which makes it means it's a little bit hard sometimes to kind of step out of that everything's always on fire and kind of say, okay, we're going to kind of look 6 months ahead and plan and that kind of stuff. So it works really nicely to have the two organizations working together.
I see. So Brian's organization is trying to get ahead of the problem, and in case it still does happen, then you pick it up.
Yeah, that's a reasonable way to look at it.
Yep. And in the case of Azure's a little unique in that, aside from, you know, sort of my ownership of that relationship on the engineering side with Jason Zander's team and other teams that sort of provide Azure services, I also have, you know, some of the core virtual machine support engineers in my direct org, and then sort of as a, you know, add-on role, I'm actually been leading more of a global end-to-end view for Azure, and so that's really been, I think, effective in allowing us to really shorten the cycle that Evan talked about. So one of, you know, and the other thing is, I just have to say, we have a just amazing relationship with the engineering team, you know, really from Scott Guthrie on down. And, you know, that's evolved, and, you know, we've sort of learned to work with each other to the extent that, you know, in the last few months, we've gotten to a daily rhythm in many of the areas where every single day we sit down together with engineering teams and, you know, review cases that weren't solved or we're having troubles with. We review cases where we need their help and really look at trends and things that we can improve in the short term. So we've kind of gone from a monthly cycle of what we call red zone, where we used to kind of go look at, you know, what are the top 10 issues that we're having in an area and how do we go, you know, address those in the platform, to, you know, in some cases a weekly triage, to now literally a daily motion where we're engaged with engineering. And I think that sort of moves us towards some of the things I know, Evan, you had kind of teed up with me, which is, you know, what's different about cloud and support in the cloud. Mm-hmm. I think that fast rhythm is certainly one of the key things that I would call out as different when you're supporting cloud than maybe some of our other products.
Yeah, and it's good and it's bad, though, Brian, right? I mean, it's good because we do have the ability to make rapid changes. You know, it's bad in the sense of it is constantly a changing place, right? I mean, this world is definitely not boring. We've got a bunch of new hires. I mean, we've added people like crazy across the board. And, you know, one of the new hires was saying, yeah, you know what, you know, every time I turn around, there's new stuff. And I said, and unlike some of the on-premises products that, you know, that doesn't change week over week, right? We always are getting new stuff in Azure.
Right.
And that's what's kind of driven some of the cadence things you're talking about. And it's been really neat. I mean, you go back to the on-premises worlds, and Sajid, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to do this, and I know, Brian, you came from the on-prem world originally. I mean, we all did. I mean, man, we were lucky sometimes if we had a regular red zone with an engineering team on a monthly basis, and they actually listened to us, that was, you know, considered a success.
Absolutely.
Right. These days, I mean, that would be to have a team that we only talk to once a month, and even then we might only get a couple of minutes, that would never fly in the cloud world. I mean, the engineering team doesn't want that. We don't want that, and that's certainly not good for our customers.
Well, I think there's two dimensions, really, to the speed factor, right? And so you've kind of hit on the speed of change in our platform, and so certainly – you know, when you think about, you know, everything from really big changes to we've released a new service or a sort of change to a service, to just really literally on our subscription management side and how we charge and bill customers and new offers and policies, those literally change every day. And we, you know, when we roll that up, it might be, you know, 20 changes our engineers have to consume in that space every day. So I think that's one element of the speed. But the other one that I think is equally important is, you know, kind of really internalizing the fact that we now are our customer's IT department. And so there's a whole speed element that I think is different than the on-prem world, in that when a customer has a problem in the cloud, you know, really they're almost entirely dependent on us to troubleshoot it and to kind of take the initial steps to determine is it a platform problem or it might be something in their solution. And so our speed of response and our, you know, the speed in which we solve issues, the expectation there is just really different in the cloud. You know, I know for on-prem issues where, you know, it's a box that's in the customer's environment and they've got engineers working on it and they're doing some stuff and we're doing some stuff. There's sort of a little bit of a dance there that can take days or weeks. You know, in the cloud, you know, customers want us to solve stuff the day they call us. And I think that creates a whole different level of complication and urgency for us.
Yeah, we were, I one of the core products that I support is ExpressRoute, specifically some of the Microsoft peering stuff. And you know, I was talking to a big, you know, enterprise customer the other day who is adopting this system, and what they were telling us, and I guess I kind of knew this, but this plays really into what you're talking about, Brian, is they were saying, hey, to their customers, they're committing a 15-minute response time and then an hour and 45 resolution time. And you think about the on-premises world, the SLAs that we have historically given our, you know, our big customers is, hey, we'll respond in an hour.
Yeah.
Right.
That says nothing about resolution. So yeah, no, your point about, you know, we're really so much tighter with the customer's infrastructure. I mean, we are their infrastructure. That's the whole point. And that means that some of these, you know, commitments that the customers have made are funneling through to us, and that's an adjustment for us and figuring out how to do this. And then some of it is learning how to solve issues faster. Some of it is just learning how to actually, what can we do in terms of, you know, platform data, exposing data, whatever, to make the entire, even once we respond, how do we make the overall process faster?
Yeah,
what can we automate? What can we, you know, what complexity can we take out of the system? Things like that.
Well, and also helping our customers, you know, really get deployed correctly in the cloud. I was just talking with some of our engineers at an event today, and you know, we were kind of talking about the fact that there is unfortunately still a bit of a perception in the industry and sort of with our customers in some cases that, you know, maybe our sales folks also, you know, may actually do a little bit to sort of support, which is, you know, the cloud's kind of auto magic, and when you move, you know, when you take your on-prem workload and move it into the cloud, it'll just work and it'll be high availability and fault tolerant. And, you know, I think we know, you know, there's a lot of things you have to do in the cloud to get that level of high availability. And some of the situations I've seen where our customers have really been impacted and weren't happy and took a long time to recover, when we really went back and looked at it, we could have told them how to deploy in a different way, and they would have had much less impact even during outages and other situations that are our fault. So getting the right sort of documentation out there and really changing our tools and our portals so that they sort of guide customers to get deployed correctly in a, you know, high availability manner, I think is also super important.
Yeah, and I think, and this, Sujeet, this goes back to what Brian was saying earlier, you know, about driving improvements in the platform and everything is, you know, in the on-premises world, what I would find is, right, we could write a doc all day long that says do this, but we don't actually know what a customer has done until they call us and say, hey, something's broken, and we look at their config, and you know, potentially we're even asking them what their config is, because they may or may not be able to share, you know, some tiers worth of data. When they're running this stuff in Azure, we can go look and see, you know, where are their VMs deployed? Are their VMs deployed in availability set? Are they in the same storage account? And I think, you know, to what Brian was saying is, as we feed this stuff in the engineering team and into the platform, we basically are trying to build things in that say, hey, we don't let you, you know, if you identify these two machines as being, you know, hey, this, you know, they're in an availability set, you know, maybe we expose, hey, did you know they're in the same storage account? Don't do that, right? Because you just lost the level of redundancy that you want. But some of that is us learning, you know, learning what we should do, and some of it is us trying to push that stuff into the platform so that, again, customers, it becomes automagic. It's never going to be total.
Right.
But we want to push it in the direction of just basically setting customers up for success for doing it, and that takes pushing that stuff in, and you have to do that, you know, as we discover when we push them in as fast as we can.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned customers, because I was going to ask Brian, how do you incorporate customer feedback into your process over there?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways we do that. You know, one is, you know, there's an element of customer feedback, I would argue, just in the cases they're opening. So, you know, when we see a lot of issues on a particular area, or particularly an emerging area that we hadn't seen before, and in some ways that is representing the feedback of customers that there's a problem here. So that may be one step removed from really direct customer feedback. You know, I'd say that the other way we represent it is somewhat, you know, a lot through my role, and I spend a fair amount of time actually talking with customers. And so within Azure, there's a group called CXP, or Customer Experience, and their kind of charter within the Azure engineering team is to sort of think end-to-end about the experience of the customer on the Azure platform. So both what's happening in the platform, you know, they partner really closely with us on support and kind of the support scenarios. Very, very customer-focused team. And so often, you know, as we get escalations or we have opportunities to meet with customers or partners, you know, in a more pleasant way, you know, we get feedback and we bring that, you know, directly back to the engineering leaders. We also often create opportunities for engineering leaders to meet directly with customers who have been impacted by outages or issues and make sure they can actually directly hear that feedback from customers. And I think that's a really important aspect of just sort of developing empathy and a truly customer-obsessed culture that, again, you haven't kind of talked about the difficulty of getting sort of time for red zones or other things with engineering. I would say, you know, in the many, many years I've been at Microsoft, you know, if I go back, you know, 15, 16 years, you know, getting a dev or a dev leader to talk to a customer, you know, it had to be, you know, sort of a really, you know, really critical issue and a very big customer. And I find today I can get, you know, VPs, you know, to talk to a, you know, any customer really that's had an issue and really needs to provide that feedback. So I think we've got a much, much opener, more open culture with our engineering teams. And so I'd say, you know, really how we do that is just by brokering those discussions. And so I'm very often on calls with a customer, with someone from the customer experience team, and then with, you know, a leader in one of the Azure service teams to really dig deep and understand what the customer's issue was and what we needed to go fix. And it might be, you know, about providing better RCAs, which is more of a process piece, or it might be really digging into their deployment and their scenario and figuring out how we can, you know, help them from a technology perspective. But I think there's a really rich connection there that's growing, and there's more and more outreach to really make sure we're getting that direct customer contact.
Yeah, no, and I think Brian actually probably understates the amount of time that he actually spends talking to direct customers. And I think in some ways that is actually representative of the shift change that we see both in support and in engineering about engaging with customers. I mean, right, because, and again, I mean, you know, given Brian's role, right, he's got some worldwide responsibilities and a lot of things on his plate, but he is, you know, spending a lot of time actually talking to, you know, customers that are impacted. Yep. Way more than, I mean, I guess, Brian, if you had your similar role 10 years ago, I guess maybe once in a while might be, again, similar situation, only the really big, you know, really important customers. And now, I've seen it because you pull me into some of those threads. I mean, it's someone I don't know who this is, but you know what? Brian cares and Scott Goo's on the thread. And you know what? We're going to go drop everything and go help this customer. And that's total shift. For those levels in the org to be that directly engaged with customers.
Well, I think that's what's really amazed me about Scott Goo. And, you know, it sort of flows from customer to him to me to you, Evan, as you know.
Yes.
In many cases. But, I mean, you know, I often, you know, sort of last thing I do at night before I, you know, close my eyes is look at my phone. And, you know, too often there's, you know, here's a mail from Scott and, you know, there's times it's, you know, a customer that's a really small partner or ISV that's, you know, a two-man shop and, you know, met Scott at a conference or whatever and mail him. And, man, he actions that. And we've had, you know, a bunch of senior people on calls taking care of those customers. And there's, you know, you could maybe make an argument that, you know, that's a wrong prioritization. But for me, that's living our value of customer obsession. And, you know, the fact that, you know, really there's no one left behind. It doesn't matter which customer mails Scott. You know, I always get a mail and we always go dig in. And, you know, there's been a couple of cases that were just awesome where we did rally and we helped someone. And, you know, afterwards I talked to them. And what we've done there is we've really created a loyal Microsoft customer, right? And they're going to go out and talk to their friend and they're going to blog and they're going to be out on social media talking about the fact that, you know, our executives and all of our support folks jumped in and helped them and made their business successful. And, you know, in some ways that's more important than the big customer because some of those customers I've talked to, if we hadn't solved their problem, you know, they were going to be out of business.
Yeah.
So the stakes are actually much higher for them, right? So I think it's great. I love that culture, and it's really made me just really re-recruited me as a Microsoft employee and just being proud to be at a company that reacts like that.
Yeah, it's good to see that from the top down. It's good to see that come from the top down, you know.
There's a guy on our team that he's really, really, really sharp engineer. You might have worked with him, Brian, at some point, Phil Ellis. But he's, you know, young guy, a couple years out of school, you know, but he's a really solid engineer. His first day on the team, I was you know, we were spinning up the team in my org, and we were looking for some people to transfer in, and we identified him, and I walked over and first day and said, hey, here's a case that, you know, we got, and somebody emailed Satya, right, and was unhappy, and that flowed down through the chain, and you know, what he pointed out to me after, which I didn't even catch, which was on the bottom of the little tagline from Satya, as you follow it down, it's from my Windows phone, right, so this was not some admin that did this. This was, you know, an exec in Microsoft flowed this down, and we responded to that customer. And that's like, that's, I mean, yeah, it's unusual to go quite that high, but it is absolutely common these days to see these executives on these threads looking for updates for customers that may not be so big.
Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you, Brian, I think you talked about outages earlier, and I think from a public facing perspective. The one number that we tout is, you know, it's like the three nines or four nines or the number of hours or minutes in the year that we were down, right? That's kind of like the metric that we report occasionally. How does that, like, how does your do you kind of factor into the, is that metric important to you, and how do you relate to it?
Well, I mean, certainly platform stability is just huge. And you know, as I talk with customers about support issues, often, you know, where we do see dissatisfaction is sort of a combination of there was a platform issue or an outage, and, you know, maybe we didn't, you know, respond as quickly as we could have or should have from a support perspective. That kind of creates the worst case scenario for customers. So, you know, outages really impact, you know, support in a couple of different ways. One is, you know, when there's some of these, you know, fairly significant outages where we take a storage outage or a networking outage, you know, we can see 100 cases in 15 minutes flow into our queues. And, you know, we're obviously not really staffed to handle 100 cases all at one time. So, mm-hmm. you know, what, you know, kind of the ripple down impact of that is clearly, you know, all of our customers, you know, may not feel great about how fast we're able to get back to them. I think we've gotten better at that, actually. But what's a little less obvious is, you know, we stop everything we're doing and everyone rallies around that outage. And so, you know, everyone has cases that they're working for other customers that aren't related to that outage. You know, those kind of unfortunately get put aside while we're dealing with the event. And so there's sort of a ripple effect where, you know, not only the customers that are impacted by the outage, but then, you know, there's sort of the set of the customers that we're working less urgent issues for also get impacted. And in fact, you know, talking about speaking to customers, I was on the phone this morning with an IT manager for a bank here in the Northwest, and you know, that was actually what he wanted to kind of talk to me about, was they had actually, you know, submitted a case during an outage, but it actually turned out that their issue was unrelated to the outage, but because things were backed up, it took us a really long time to get to them and help them. And you know, we were just kind of talking through how we were going to try and make that better, and you know, what they could have done differently to maybe, you know, get a little bit better experience there. But, you know, there's certainly any time the platform's down, there's high impact on our customers and on us. But the one thing I can tell you is, you know, I sound like I'm just kind of really over sort of singing the praises of our engineering group. But I think it is just important that people understand the level of commitment and sort of understanding they have. You know, I sit in meetings pretty much all month, different rhythms with Scott Gu and Jason Zander and their directs, you know, in a whole bunch of different meetings. And, you know, it's gotten to where, you know, what they are working on is, you know, things that impact stability, things that help us support the platform better, and then features. And, you know, anyone who's been around, you know, Microsoft and our dev teams for a long time knows that is not the order it used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, to the extent that, you know, we've got teams who are ring fencing, you know, complete teams of devs who are only working on kind of supportability features to help us support the platform better and drive stability. So, you know, there's definitely an incredibly strong sense of, you know, kind of accountability and urgency to, you know, get after the issues that are impacting stability. Because frankly, that is the biggest challenge some of our customers are having, is just, you know, really feeling like they can rely on the platform.
Yep. As a matter of fact, I was going to ask you one final question from my side is, you know, what do you tell customers and advise them as to how to take advantage of, how best to use Azure support, right? Like, what's the process that they should be, is there some right way to do it, or How should they go about getting the best of Azure support?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a couple of things. So I'm going to back all the way up slightly before, you know, the direct answer to your question, which is, you know, both our customers and our field and everyone who engages with customers, you know, the first step there is helping customers really understand how to deploy, take advantage of availability sets and other features of Azure that, you know, kind of get you into a high availability mode so that when there are outages or issues, you're not impacted. Right. So that's kind of the step even before how do I use support well,
right,
which is a little bit help yourself. But then, you know, I think the second biggest thing is, you know, get the right level of support. And this is really no different than on-prem. And, you know, I didn't kind of go into a long introduction, but I started at Microsoft as a TAM in Premier, and I spent almost 15 years at Microsoft, you know, in different roles in Premier, including running worldwide Premier business. And, you know, one of the things we always saw was where customers were really unhappy with Premier, you know, probably 70-80% of the time, there was a mismatch between sort of the level of Premier they purchased and, you know, what they really needed based on the criticality of their environment. And I would say that's become even more of an issue in cloud. So, you know, we talked about these escalations that reach Scott or reach Satya. I mean, there's been a number of those where it's literally a customer who's bought our lowest level of support, which is called developer. It's $30 a month, and it's really meant for a developer, that's the name. So someone who's just, you know, building stuff, maybe doing some test and dev, but nothing in production. And, you know, we've had customers who were running a mission critical for their business website or environment that bought that level of support, which doesn't even let you submit a high severity issue, you know, then being really unhappy because we didn't help them right away, right? So I think our response time SLA for developer is something like 8 hours. You know, and so there was a real mismatch of sort of the need and expectation for those customers relative to what we'd committed to provide. And so, you know, one of the best things customers can do is really be realistic about, you know, the impact of their business versus what they need in support. You know, if you take $1 million loss for an hour of downtime, a $30 a month support plan is probably not the right one for you.
Got it.
The second thing I would say is use the portal. You know, predominantly for any other offering but Premier, that is the only way you can submit a support incident. But for our Premier customers, which tend to be our large enterprise customers, I mean, they're sort of trained to call us on the phone to submit an incident. And we lose so much context around, you know, sort of the resources in Azure. And we're increasingly working with engineering to make the incident submission workflow capture a ton of data and information that we then, you know, workflow to the engineers. So they're starting with a pretty rich set of data to solve the problem. When you call in on the phone, we don't have any of that. So,
correct.
That's a great point, Brian. I mean, I was joking with some new hires the other day that I have seen cases where the only notes in the case from the Premier customer is when the engineer calls me, I'll tell them what the problem is. and then I contrast that with, you know, the Azure cases that we get in that come into the Azure portal. And again, my specialty up until recently was Azure networking, which is almost exclusively a platform level of data, right? It's almost all that data is platform, not in the VM itself. And there is a very high percentage of cases that if they go through the portal, we have the subscription ID, we have an automated report that runs against it. When I open that up, I have all the information I need to diagnose their problem. And a lot of times I can turn around and say, hey, here's your issue, right? The very first contact, here's not only what your problem is, but here's the solution. And sometimes if it's something that is really broken at the platform level that I can do something about, you know, versus a misconfiguration, I may even have fixed it for them, right? And so, yeah, now your point is really, really important, Brian. I mean, if any way that they can give us the context to be more effective is just better for everybody in the end.
Yep, and something we just launched a couple of months ago is a project we did called Cloud Knows Premier. And what it does is it basically goes up and matches Azure subscription IDs to customers to their Premier agreements. So it used to be a little kludgy to actually connect together the customer subscription and the portal to their Premier agreement, but now we've actually sort of got an automated process that does that matching, and so most of our Premier customers should be able to just go into the portal and their Premier contract is already connected to their Azure subscriptions, and so it's a pretty seamless experience. So definitely, you know, making sure, you know, all the folks who touch customers are aware of that on the Premier side, and encouraging them to go through the portal is really important.
Great. That's very useful. Thank you. That's all I had from my side, Brian. Evan, anything else you have?
This is great, Brian. I appreciate you coming and sharing your perspective. I mean, again, I know you have a technical history, you know, but I'm still kind of, you know, deep in the technical these days, but you come in with, you know, a very different perspective. And like, you know, you said, we partner up very, very closely to get, you know, the holistic story back to engineering, and it's a great partnership, and look forward to future partnerships as well. And I will say, you missed one primary thing that you should have told the audience: listen to the Azure podcast, and then they will have better experience.
that is the secret sauce.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying. But thank you very much, Brian. Appreciate you taking your time late in the evening in Redmond. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
You're welcome. All right, thank you. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.